from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by 10,000 Villages. 10,000 Villages' 13th annual showcase of Fair Trade Oriental Rugs will be held March 9th through the 12th at their store, 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. On Tuesday, March 10th at 7 p.m., an informal seminar about Oriental Rugs will be held at the store. For more information, call 352-8200.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Prostate cancer affects one in six American men. On the program today, we'll look at the latest developments in prevention, detection, and treatment, and we'll talk about other issues important to men and their loved ones following a diagnosis of prostate cancer. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. David Bostwick. He's a medical doctor with more than two decades of experience in prostate cancer, bladder cancer, and urologic diseases. From 1991 to 1999, he was a professor of pathology and urology at the Mayo Clinic. He left in 1999 to found Bostwick Laboratories in Virginia. The author of many books and articles, including the textbook Urologic Surgical Pathology, Dr. Bostwick is the lead editor of the American Cancer Society's Complete Guide to Prostate Cancer. Listeners, I invite your question for Dr. David Bostwick. Here are the phone numbers. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The Complete Guide to Prostate Cancer is published by the American Cancer Society. Dr. Bostwick, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Celeste, for having me.
My pleasure. We already have a listener who would like to talk with you this afternoon, so let's go and talk with our caller on line one, a listener in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for being on this show. I have a question about an elderly brother, and originally the thought was that his bladder did not empty because of an enlarged prostate, and they worked on that. Is Proscar something that's supposed to shrink an enlarged prostate?
Yes, Proscar is a drug that's been available for a number of years ago. It shrinks the prostate, the benign prostate, up to 40%. It's quite effective in most men.
Well, it didn't really shrink it, and then they decided that then they gave him something to relax the sphincter, I guess, between the bladder and the urethra. Is that the right word?
Yes, it is.
And then they discovered that his bladder no longer contracted, and it was recommended that we see a neurologist, which we have an appointment to do. However, my general question is, can an enlarged prostate do anything to keep a bladder from contracting?
Yes, it can. The problem with enlargement of the prostate is that it causes a damming back effect by blocking the urine flow. It's a common cause for actually many men as they get older. The prostate enlarges and it blocks the urethra, so they have to get up multiple times at night to go to the bathroom because they can't empty their bladder completely. If it continues for a long time, the bladder wall itself becomes thickened. It's a response to this damming back effect. The bladder tries to protect itself by its wall becoming thickened, and that in and of itself can cause problems with contractility or the ability of the bladder to empty itself during normal process.
He's been using a catheter for close to a year.
Yes.
Would surgery to make the prostate smaller have any positive effect in allowing the bladder to contract more?
It may, and what we're discussing in many ways is what Ronald Reagan had. He had enlargement of the prostate and ultimately required surgery to unblock it, very much like a Roto-Rooter type of operation, and I'm simplifying, and forgive me for that. But yes, that can help, but because of the complexity of what you're describing and the potential for secondary bladder problems, I really have to refer you more directly to a urologist who would deal in that particular area.
Well, we had seen a urologist, and they finally said, no, there is nothing that we can do. The bladder just does not contract. And so it was suggested that we talk to a urologist, a neurologist at our local clinic, that sometimes things press on nerves and keep the bladder from contracting. In your experience, is that likely?
It certainly can happen, yes. There are a lot of nerves in that area, and when organs become enlarged for any reason, if they press on a nerve, it's very much like if you cross your legs and you leave your leg crossed for a while, then your leg falls asleep.
Right.
That's actually when the nerve is undergoing not real damage in that sense, but at least it's losing some functionality. If that happens for weeks or months, of course, the nerve can just become completely useless. So the answer is yes. I think that a specialist is what you need for what you're describing. This is not a typical or a common problem.
When you say specialist, we've been seeing a urologist over the past year for him. Are there specialists other than urologists and neurologists whom we might want to see for this circumstance?
Well, if it is definitely nerve damage, then a neurologist, N-E-U-R, would be the one to see.
Right.
But there are urologists within the field who specialize in bladder contractility problems.
How does one identify these practitioners?
The best way is to ask the urologist that you're seeing. They'll give you the best advice, really.
Okay. And these are people who specialize in contracting or not contracting of the bladder.
Yes, there have been books written on this. There are conferences held within the field, but not every urologist goes to one of those meetings.
Right. I know that sometimes nerves can be awakened and muscles can be awakened with stimulation, electrical stimulation. Is there any evidence that one's bladder can be taught to contract again with this kind of electrical stimulation?
It does work for some people. I can't really respond to the specific case you're talking about. We do know that the longer there is inactivity, the less likely that there is going to be return of function. So I would probably act with all due haste in this particular instance.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Just a follow-up here, I've got a couple other listeners waiting to talk with us. If this caller wanted to do some research, what would the key words be? Would it be bladder contractility? Was that the word you used?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Contractility, just like it sounds. And that would probably give a number of sites that would address that question.
Okay, very good. Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Champaign-Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hello, interesting question on diets and maybe the theory or the mechanism behind the diets. What about decreasing fats like animal fats and increasing vitamins like and the saw palmetto? Chow.
Yeah, the exact cause of prostate cancer is unknown, but the best available evidence, and there's a modest amount of evidence, supports that oxidative stress is probably one of the causes, if not the direct cause. Therefore, your question is very appropriate and right on target because the things that you're addressing really get to the heart of this. We believe that taking vitamin E and selenium, the trace element selenium, don't oversupplement, but taking modest amounts of that and perhaps some other antioxidants, soy protein perhaps, lycopene, which is present in pizza sauce and tomatoes, raw tomatoes, that this combination of antioxidants may actually be of considerable value in dealing with prostate and preventing prostate cancer. And even if you have prostate cancer, there is some evidence to suggest that taking these supplements in modest doses may slow the progression of the cancer, which is probably an important thing to look at as well. The evidence is not perfect, however. In terms of fats and high-fat diet, we believe that high-fat diet may or may not be causative of prostate cancer, but we believe that a high-fat diet is like pouring gasoline on the fire. If you've got prostate cancer and you've got a high-fat diet, or you're obese, which is effectively the same thing, you have a lot of energy on board, if you will. That's what we're really talking about, energy stores. And patients who have excess energy available to them, either directly in their diet or in stored fat because of obesity, that they are probably at increased risk for acceleration or more rapid growth of their prostate cancer. The data are not perfect on this, but the best available data supports that. I do take vitamins on a daily basis. I recommend them, and most physicians that I know of are recommending that for their patients. But don't over-supplement, whatever that might mean. Okay.
That's a tricky question, isn't it?
Yes.
You don't want to go over what the recommendations are. Okay.
The question of saw palmetto is interesting because that particular agent, which has been around and is popular in some circles, has some hormonal activity as well. And for some patients, it can give sizable relief, particularly in men who have obstructive symptoms, the ones we were talking about earlier, in which the prostate is slightly enlarged and they have increased likelihood of getting up in the middle of the night to urinate, or they have difficulty getting the urine stream started, if you will. And saw palmetto may help in that regard. Does it prevent prostate cancer? We don't know. There's certainly theoretical evidence to support it, and a number of men believe it sufficiently that they're taking it. And I know of at least one physician that actually does recommend it to his patients. It's, of course, non-prescription, but it's something to probably investigate. We talk about that in our book, the American Cancer Society book, The Guide to Prostate Cancer.
And another one of the things that you recommend in the book is to boost fruits and vegetables.
Yes, it's very easy. If it's good for your heart, it's probably good for your prostate. And there are no surprises here. I wish I had a magic bullet or, you know, a special answer. You know, don't take carbohydrates or something, which I have trouble with because there's so little data to support that, hard evidence, scientific evidence. But we've found, and everyone agrees in this field, that taking fruits and vegetables is certainly a good thing to do for your prostate and your heart. If nothing else, it displaces fat from your diet. But more importantly, it delivers a number of antioxidants, particularly, both fruits and vegetables are filled with things. Things that you probably don't like are things that rabbits eat, spinach, broccoli, things like that are filled with antioxidants.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana on line 3. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Dr. Boswick, I have two questions. One, I'm 79 years old, and I was on Proscar for 11 years, and my PSA during that time was between a 0.6 and 0.8, and I know that Proscar does lower PSA. Reason it was prescribed was because of frequency and urgency, and that was certainly handled during daytime. At nighttime, I would get up several times, every couple of hours, but I didn't have any side effects. And when the research came out that demonstrated that Proscar does reduce the risk of prostate cancer, but for those men who do take Proscar, if they do develop prostate cancer, it will be more aggressive than people who are not on prostate cancer. My primary care physician then said he was no longer going to write prescriptions for Proscar, and he suggested I take Flomax. Now, I've been on Flomax for about a year and a half, and what Flomax seems to have done is that I only have to get up during the night perhaps once, maybe twice at the most, and I don't know about some of the side effects. I think sometimes I may be getting some of those gastrointestinal. And so I'm wondering what you think about that decision. I really agonized about whether I should give up Proscar since, you know, I think it was helpful, and the research indicates it's a double-edged sword.
Well, I appreciate you asking this question. It's a very intelligent question, and it's one that doctors have been asking for almost a year and a half since the results of the prostate cancer prevention trial came out. Simply, let me restate, Proscar was tested for 7 years in 18,000 men. Half of them got sugar pill or placebo, and half of them got Proscar. The question that was asked is, can Proscar prevent prostate cancer in a low-risk group of men? At the end of the report or the study, they undertook biopsies in those men, and they found that there was a 24.8% reduction in the likelihood of prostate cancer in those taking finasteride, also known as Proscar. That they were expecting the reduction would be maybe 10%, perhaps 15%. They would have been extremely happy with 15%. Deliriously happy with 20%, and they got 24.8%. This was a grand slam home run by all measures. There are very few things in medicine that have as profound a positive effect as the finasteride or Proscar findings. The problem, as you point out, is that the men that did get prostate cancer who were on finasteride or Proscar developed a cancer that by grading was higher than those men who were taking just the sugar pill and developed prostate cancer. I've written a paper on this, actually, that's in the literature now, and I've talked to literally hundreds of physicians. I'm a practicing pathologist. What that means is that I'm the one with the microscope who looks under the microscope to determine if it's cancer or not, and all I do is prostate cancer work. That's what we do here at Bostrick Laboratories, my colleagues and I. And we use the grading system that's been around for almost 40 years called the Gleason grading system. The problem is that grading system has never been validated after the use of hormonal therapy, and Proscar is a form of hormonal therapy. Therefore, the grading has not been validated, which means that it may actually be grading bias. There are a number of possible explanations for the higher grade cancer. One is, it's grading bias. It's changes that cause it to look like it's higher grade, but after 7 years of the drug, it's an artifact, if you will, and I deal with a lot of artifacts because that's the nature of looking under the microscope. The second possibility is that it's a real effect, that Proscar has a fabulous effect on lower intermediate cancers, but not on high-grade cancers. My personal belief is that it's all grading bias, or much of it's grading bias, and that there is no reason to stop taking Proscar. I had a chance to talk to the head of that particular study, Ian Thompson, last week at a meeting, and he is prescribing Proscar to his patients. They are reevaluating the data. They're looking at the study again to see if the high-grade cancer could actually just be grading bias. There are ways of doing that that were not done originally. So we're going to wait for the results of that. That should be available by the end of this year. My belief is that in this particular instance, it was a very successful trial in preventing prostate cancer. More than anything in human history in prostate cancer, we've been able to prevent prostate cancer in a relatively low-risk group of patients. And the high-grade cancer that came out was probably artifact. But like I say, I can't prove that. And at the present time, until we have more data, it remains an unanswered question. But it's a wonderful problem. I wish I could give you a definitive answer, but no one has that, including the people that ran that trial.
So do you think it would be wise for me to continue on Flomax until the results of this study come out?
It sounds like you're having a good result with this other drug, the Flomax, as opposed to Proscar. And in that case, if it's working, stay the course. My gosh.
I don't know. I haven't had a PSA since then, but I assume it will probably double since I'm off Proscar.
Yeah, and that's reasonable. I wouldn't get too worried about that. If you're 79 years of age, PSA can be considerably higher than what you've had in the past. The 0.6 to 0.8 is very low indeed, mm-hmm. Even on finasteride or Proscar. So you're probably in pretty good shape. Now, PSA is not a perfect test for prostate cancer. And what is better than the absolute value is to look at the changes over time. And, of course, you've done a very good job of that because you know what your PSA is, and you'll be able to follow it. We're talking about prostate-specific antigen, the blood test for prostate cancer. We mentioned this at length in the Complete Guide to Prostate Cancer, the book. done for the American Cancer Society. But in the end, there is no perfect lab test. But I've talked to women who study breast cancer, as well as some men that are in that field. They wish they had a blood test as good as PSA for breast cancer. So it may not be a perfect test. It may be under siege from some quarters about its lack of accuracy. But it's better than not having it. That's certainly the case. It's free. It's inexpensive, I should say. It's widely available, and it's a reproducible test.
Okay. May I ask another quick question?
Please. Certainly.
Let's see. I'm wondering about the advisability of taking 1,500 milligrams of calcium. I have my primary care physician said I have some beginning osteoporosis, and so he prescribed 800 IUs of vitamin D and 1,500 milligrams of calcium. And I've seen some indication, some research points out that above 800 milligrams, it may increase the potential risk for prostate cancer in men. Is that correct?
The data linking calcium intake and prostate cancer is decidedly weak. And I wouldn't use that as an excuse for taking or not taking calcium. I can't address the actual dosages here. That's beyond my area of study. But the risk of prostate cancer should not be a contraindication for taking calcium supplementation at any level.
Thank you very much. You've been very helpful, Dan.
Thank you.
Thanks for the questions this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about prostate cancer. Our guest is Dr. David Bostwick. He's a medical doctor, a pathologist with more than two decades of experience in the field. He is the founder of Bostwick Laboratories in Virginia. The lab specializes in the interpretation of prostate biopsies. He's past president of the International Society of Urological Pathology, and he's the lead editor of the American Cancer Society's Complete Guide to Prostate Cancer. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions this afternoon for our guest, Dr. David Bostwick. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to perhaps some of the basics. With our last caller, you talked with him about Proscar and its benefit or potential benefit for men who are at low risk of prostate cancer. What are the risk factors for prostate cancer?
Well, the most important is being male. And the reason I bring that up, it sounds obvious, but 80% of men by the age of 80 years will have microscopic evidence of prostate cancer. So the bottom line is that virtually all men will get this. It's not a rare problem. It's a common problem. We know that only 1 in 5 will actually develop clinical evidence, but I say only 1 in 5. That's 20% of American men today will be told that sometime in their lifetime you have prostate cancer. It's really an incredible issue. It's more likely that you're going to be told that if you've got a family history of prostate cancer or if you're African American. Those are the two most important known risk factors other than being male.
Yeah. And African American men are more likely to die of this cancer than white men.
Yes, that's correct. Part of that is that we diagnose prostate cancer in African Americans later in its course, at least in the typical population. That may not be quite as true in the military where there's presumptive equal access to care. But African Americans tend to come to their physician later than Caucasians or even Hispanic men. That's been shown in multiple studies. And that's one of the reasons that we wrote this book. We were all volunteers putting this information together for the American Cancer Society. And we did that because we want men to get tested. We believe that early detection can save your life, and particularly for African-American men. The problem is that there is a cultural bias. The two tests we use for finding prostate cancer are the blood test, PSA, that we've talked about, as well as the digital rectal examination. And there is a strong cultural bias against digital examination among African-American men. This has been discussed repeatedly by the American Cancer Society. There's something about having the doctor or anyone put their finger up there. Well, the reality is it can save your life. Doctors do it all day, every day. It's part of what we do for a living. It's a normal part of a function, if you will. It's not painful. It's not that big a deal. It isn't for the doctor, and it shouldn't be for the patient. But for whatever reason, that has kept a lot of African-American men away from getting treatment, and that's one of the issues. There are other possible issues, the equal access to health care issues, that are beyond my understanding.
Yeah. At what age should men be tested, both with the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen blood test, and the DRE, the digital rectal exam?
Both tests should be used, and there may be new tests coming out. Our laboratory currently is offering a genetic test for prostate cancer, but that's not widely available yet. But others are coming in the next few years. Once you get tested at the age of 50, every man at 50 years of age should have these tests. And if you're at a higher risk, a family history of prostate cancer, brother, father, son, uncle, grandfather with prostate cancer, or if you're African-American, you should get tested at 45 years of age. There's some groups, that's the American Cancer Society recommendations, there's some groups that are actually recommending even earlier than those ages because of our belief that early detection allows us to have many options for dealing with prostate cancer. And the earlier we find it, the higher the likelihood of cure. We cure most men with prostate cancer when we treat them. That's the good news. You can be cured. This is not like pancreatic or lung or even breast cancer, in which patients are still doing very well with all of those, but prostate cancer has an even greater likelihood of success if caught earlier than many of those.
Okay, so if you're at risk, 45, and everyone by 50, all men.
All men.
And is this an annual? Should these tests be done annually?
Annually is good. At least every 2 years. Annually is better. And again, the reason it's better is that serum PSA absolute value may not be as useful as watching it changing over time.
Mm.
That's the real critical utility of prostate-specific antigen, the blood test.
Okay, so you want to know your base, and then you can keep an eye on it from there.
That's right.
Like the caller we talked with who knew exactly what his number was.
Yes.
How often are results suspicious? You know, how accurate is the PSA?
Well, PSA has come under a lot of controversy recently because it's an imperfect test. It's a better test of the size of the prostate than it is the presence or absence of prostate cancer. Therefore, the sensitivity for prostate cancer is not bad. That is to say, if you've got prostate cancer, it probably, or at least it might, raise your PSA. The specificity is the problem. Specificity is a measure of whether you actually have the disease you're measuring, and the specificity is poor. That means to say you could have an elevated PSA and not have prostate cancer. So, yes, does it get people excited and potentially upset? Perhaps. But we know that even what used to be a normal PSA, somewhere between 2.5 and 4 nanograms per milliliter for absolute value, that 15% of those patients will have prostate cancer. And that's a small but significant number of patients. One of the interesting findings from the prostate cancer prevention trial, and let me take a moment because this is very exciting news that was lost in some of the other things that came out. We took men who had no evidence of prostate cancer, who had a PSA of 3 or less, and followed them for 7 years. This is what, when I say we, I mean the prostate cancer prevention trial. We followed more than 10,000 men in this study. And the expectation of prostate cancer in this group by the statisticians was only about 8%, maybe 9 or 10% in the ones who were most liberal with their numbers. We found that fully 1 in 4, or 25% of men, actually had prostate cancer at the end of 7 years.
Mm.
That was an enormous surprise. It was 3 times more likely than was expected in that group. And that's because at the beginning of the trial, these men had a PSA less than 3. That's probably as important as the other news about finasteride or Proscar itself. We know that PSA is imperfect, and one should probably get checked up for PSA if it's over 2.5 nanograms per mil, which means you get a biopsy or at least a follow-up, a closer follow-up if your PSA is abnormal, ahead of 2.5, not 4.0 like it used to be.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign on line 1. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a problem with passing blood every once in a while, like maybe two or three times a month, a month. And then another month I will go by and not pass blood. And I've been checked several times by urologists. I did find out that I was, per everything you read, that you should take at least a baby aspirin a day. And I never considered that as medication. And then they found out that I was taking the baby aspirins, and they really about blew sky high because my blood is very thin, apparently, and I've always had, growing up, I used to have nosebleeds all the time. But it seemed like there's no answer to that. And earlier I have had cauterization of the going into the prostate. But I still pass blood, and it's really scary. And it's always at nighttime, too. Have any comments about that or thoughts?
When you talk about blood, you're talking about gross blood as opposed to just red-tinged urine. Is that correct?
Well, it's, yes. It's
probably both.
Blood at the beginning.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
And then it stops, and then you got regular urine.
Yeah, what I don't want to do is to tell you exactly the cause, because I don't know the cause, and it could be very serious, and it could just be just an inconsequential blood vessel that just happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, if you will. If you've had it for a long time, it's probably less of a problem than if it comes on immediately, but it's an issue. In the end, I have to refer you to keep going to the urologist and getting checked for this, because hematuria, which is what we refer to it, or blood in the urine, can be caused by many things. It can be caused by kidney disease, bladder disease, prostate disease, urethral or penile disease. If it's gross blood, it's not from the kidney. The kidney is going to give you the red-tinged urine, at least most of the time. So the color of the urine is something we should pay attention to, actually, and it can make a difference. Because it can give you a rather good measure of what's going on. But I don't know the real cause for you. My son has nosebleeds, and he's been told that his issue is simply that he's got a blood vessel that's near the surface that just occasionally, for whatever reason, it just breaks through, and then it stops of its own volition. He's had that for years, and hopefully it'll go away with time. Even the same thing may be the case with you. And your urethra could be like your nose. I don't know if I've ever made that analogy before. It's an interesting possibility.
I think it must be.
In terms of aspirin, I do too. I take a small aspirin a day. The data supporting that for colon cancer are profound. There are more than 8 studies on that. It's a very good suggestion for both men and women. But it should only be done in those that don't have stomach problems, because aspirin does definitely cause erosion of the gastric mucosa, stomach mucosa, but also in those who have thin blood. So I have to refer you back to your physician for that one.
Well, I've stopped completely with that.
Uh-huh.
So, okay, I guess I should continue to do that, not take any aspirins.
If he's told you not to, or she's told you not to, it's
yes.
Good. It's prudent practice not to.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana on line 2. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
A year and a half ago, we had to deal in my family with the diagnosis of early prostate cancer, and it was really hard to try to figure out what to do. And I finally recommended that go see more than one doctor. Go see the oncologist as well as the urologist surgeon, and we got a very different story, an interpretation of risks of side effects after seeing the oncologist. And I said to him, why are we getting this? And he said, well, I'm giving you my results, not just the general statistics that are out here. These are the results that I've been getting with my patients. And he had a much lower risk of urinary incontinence and impotence than we were hearing from the urologist surgeon for radiation or for surgery. And ultimately, we decided to go with this. And my husband had implantation of these very small radioactive iodine pellets. And as far as we're concerned, that was the way to go for him. But I would recommend from this small piece of experience that people not just stick with getting the opinion of a surgeon, but also, and of course it depends on an individual situation, but to talk about it some more and find out what else is available in your area for your particular situation, and not just take the advice of somebody whose main tool is to do surgery. And when I talked with the oncologist about this, he said that prostate treatment for cancer was sort of at the stage where breast cancer treatment used to be, where if you just talked with the surgeon, you ended up with a mastectomy. Whereas in facilities where there is a team approach and multiple disciplines look at an individual's particular situation, that both with prostate cancer and with excuse me, I'm having trouble with something I just ate, that you're more likely actually to get a less invasive approach when you have a team approach looking at the individual situation. So I just wanted to pass along that individual experience and see what you thought about it.
Well, I have a number of responses, and I think you've done a wonderful job of steering through this field of uncertainty. Prostate cancer, 230,000 men roughly this year are going to be told that they have prostate cancer. Probably two have been told that since we've been on the telephone today, maybe three. And they all enter this incredible area of uncertainty. At the same medical center, with the same cancer, a patient can be told you should have surgery. By another physician, he can be told that you should have radiation therapy. A third will say you should have radiation therapy, but it should be seed implantation. A fourth will recommend freezing the prostate, a procedure we call cryosurgery. And a fifth may even recommend watchful waiting or active surveillance, where he'll say, or she'll say, well, let's just follow the PSA and the digital rectal exam for some time. Let's see what happens. We're not going to do anything right now. The bottom line is that perhaps more than any other cancer in the human body, prostate cancer creates this tremendous level of uncertainty. And it's the real reason that we wrote this American Cancer Society's Complete Guide to Prostate Cancer, because we believe strongly, all of the 30 or so volunteer contributors to this book who labored this, took this labor of love on for the American Cancer Society and the patients, we believe that the empowered patient, the patient that knows all the possible options and then acts and makes a decision in the setting of uncertainty, will have a better outcome than the patient who just goes in and says, well, doc, just do whatever you want. In other words, ignorance is not bliss when it comes to prostate cancer. Know what you're dealing with. Empower yourself. Men get very depressed when they're told they have prostate cancer. They think they're going to die tomorrow. Nobody dies tomorrow from prostate cancer. This is a slow-growing cancer for the most part. It doesn't mean we can ignore it, but it means, in general, it's one that men do very well with in the short and intermediate term. There are men who have bone involvement with prostate cancer who can live 5, 10, even I've seen 15-year survivors with proven bone metastases. That's uncommon, but it does happen. So in the end, one needs to learn what is best for oneself. Now, can I ask you a question? Were you more proactive than your husband in pursuing treatment?
I pushed to have him do the research, which he didn't like doing because dealing with medical stuff. But I said, this is about your body. But then I said, I don't like this imbalance that I'm seeing between in the risks of I thought the risks were too high with surgery for impotence and incontinence. I said, you know, you still have a long life, potential life to live, and those are things that could be really life-changing. And that was part of why we went with the other. But the other thing that the oncologist said, and he said was, did your surgeon say that I see 20% of his surgery patients for further radiation treatment, because they're not able to get it all a lot of the time? And we said, no, he didn't say that.
No, he didn't say that, yeah.
And I said, well, how can that be? And he said, well, that you can't always get all of the prostate out because some of it's in places where you can't reach it. And also because you leave some cells behind, which made sense to me. So I was pleased, and we continue to be pleased with having gone with the implants. And it was, in terms of time off from work. It was, you know, time for tests and so forth. It was a day in the hospital, a day for recovery, and maybe a day and a half for recovery, so roughly. Back to work for this the implants.
That's got to be almost miraculous if you think about it. A major cancer, a very serious illness, and one loses less work time than if you have influenza or something like that. It's really an amazing thing. Seed implantation was not an option 15 years ago. It's one of the things that has come into practice just in the last decade and a half. And the data now suggests that for at least some men, it's a very, very good choice. But all the treatments work. That's one of the problems. They work to varying degrees. And ultimately, one has to know individually what's best for you and for your family. And I applaud you for taking the initiative. I think women may be somewhat better on average than men in taking control of their lives when they confront an illness such as this. You know, for many men, they've never really had to confront the possibility of their mortality or loss of sexuality or other things like that. I've met 50-year-old men who say, I don't care about sex anymore, or I don't care about potency, I just don't want to die from the prostate cancer, so do whatever you want. And then I've met 80-year-old men who say, I'd rather be dead than lose my ability to have sex. It's really an amazing thing, and it's a very personal thing, and both of those men are right. Being able to articulate or understand what's best for you. All the treatments have side effects. Even watchful waiting or active surveillance is not a perfect treatment for prostate cancer. So one has to weigh the benefits and the risk. That's the reason that we wrote this book. And the book was written by people who do this for a living. All I do all day, every day, is look at prostate biopsies. That's what myself and my 15 colleague pathologists here do. The people in this book, the surgeon who wrote the surgical chapter, the person who wrote the chapter on seed implantation, that's all that they do. And we've tried to eliminate the biases from the book. You mentioned a little bit about physician bias. Physicians are human beings. And remember that they don't work. You don't work for them. They work for you. It's a critical element. The patient has to take control of that relationship, in my opinion.
I want to thank the listener for her call and go and take another call. Listener in Urbana on line 3. Hello.
Yeah, two questions. One, I was wondering, I heard earlier you said in the way of prevention that vitamin E and selenium, if I heard you correctly, were a good thing to take. Did you have amounts in mind, a dosage?
Well, that's part of the problem. If you're already getting adequate selenium in your diet, you shouldn't supplement with it.
Oh.
What's adequate? Well, that's a question unto itself. The same with vitamin E. That's why I really can't give you a good answer for that. What we're doing in our laboratory here, and I know some other laboratories, we're actually in the process of setting up a selenium assay so we can measure baseline selenium from toenails. It's remarkably simple to do, but we just haven't set that up so that we'd be able to make a more intelligent statement and answer your question definitively. So if you give me a month, I'd be able to give you a much more definitive answer.
Can you say anything about what would be too much vitamin E or selenium just in terms of the supplementation?
Actually, that's the problem again because...
Okay. I have another question. I read recently that in terms of red wine, there's a compound called resveratrol.
Yes.
And can you talk about that? Because I understand that looks at least looked promising last year when I heard about this.
Yeah, there are a number of compounds in isolation that have been shown to be of great value in stopping prostate cancer growth in test tubes and in animals. I'm not familiar exactly with the data on resveratrol, but yes, red wine has been linked with slowing prostate cancer growth, according to at least some preliminary studies. That has not been proven in human beings to be the case, and therein lies the issue with that. But frankly, I don't think it's going to hurt. The problem we have is if we recommend like one glass of wine, Americans think that more is better than less, so we'll take 4 or 5 glasses of wine, and then you actually get to a point of too much. It's like the selenium and vitamin E story. I can't tell you what the exact amounts are, but if you take too much selenium, you can get subtoxic levels of selenium. You may not know that you're taking too much, but it may actually cause increased DNA damage in the prostate. We actually showed that in a paper last year that we published on Sling. Mm. So without giving you exact numbers, I think that the concept is certainly valid. Red wine's good for your heart, as best we can tell, and that may be the agent for that as well. Getting back to my earlier thought, if it's good for your heart, it's good for your prostate.
Yeah. One of the things that is in the Complete Guide to Prostate Cancer is some information about supplements and alternative treatments and complementary therapies. And one of the bottom lines in that portion of the book is to talk with your physician about what you're doing. And I know that my physician always wants to know even, you know, what kind of vitamins I'm taking. Or am I taking aspirin on a regular basis? I mean, they kind of want to know. He wants to know, you know, what's going on. And I'm happy to answer his questions, but I think it's great that he asks them. And I suppose maybe here to wrap up, you'd want to talk just briefly about good communication with your doctor?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a critical element. Physicians today are very busy. They're in a great hurry. That's, I think, a truism for all physicians. And it's critical that a patient at any stage in their dealing with prostate cancer or any disease make a plan to ensure that the physician spends enough time discussing what's going on. If the physician doesn't know, he or she should say they don't know, because they don't know everything. There's so much going on, particularly in the prostate cancer field. So in that regard, communication is critical. You've got to tell your doctor what you're dealing with as well. You know, it's interesting. When I went to medical school, I was taught that taking vitamins simply created expensive urine. And the body regulates vitamins and trace minerals so carefully that, of course, these are of no value. Of course, now it's 25 years later, and we know that these things have profound effects on the brain, the prostate, the heart, the skin, all organs. It's not the answer. It's not the only answer to prevention or even treating or dealing with prostate cancer and other illnesses, but it is a sizable area of importance. We know that about 70% of patients are taking supplements of some kind. That's been published, and yet we don't ask very often. Maybe it's partly the physicians who are not trained or are not interested or don't have the time or whatever. But it's worthwhile discussing that. The aspirin, we heard about the baby mm-hmm. aspirin earlier, and that's a critically important piece of information for a physician. So communicate. The physician is there for you. He or she's not there for themselves.
Okay. So if he or she doesn't ask, maybe you should
volunteer.
You should ask. Volunteer.
Be assertive. Yeah, again, the knowledgeable and empowered patient. That's why we wrote the Complete Guide to Prostate Cancer, to empower patients.
Yeah, help us make informed decisions. Dr. Bostwick, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. My pleasure.
David Bostwick is the lead editor for the American Cancer Society's Complete Guide to Prostate Cancer. 6 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the bean pit rallying. They pushed both the wheat and the corn higher throughout the day. That is, the weather over the weekend was a little drier than expected in Brazil and Argentina, so this time it was trade the fact and not the rumor, as futures in the bean pit were up 18 cents in the nearby March contract. A couple of other things that are happening there as we read on the websites from DTN and on the floor. Mr. Wilhelmy saying he believes that the non-commercials now are net longs. I believe on the air, Dave Dickey told me at noon that Sue Martin is saying that, and then there is at least one other source that we have who was expecting that would be the case for the beans, so that the funds may have really finally changed their positions. As of last Tuesday, they were still fairly short this marketplace, but they may be coming long this market. We'll have a better idea, of course, when the commitment of traders comes out on Friday afternoon. It will only be updated as of Tuesday of this week, so we'll have to stay tuned. It's a little lag time, but it'll help out as we try to figure out what's exactly happening here. From the wheat pit day, March contract had a high of 337.5, the low at 324.5, settled 14 higher at 337.25. May futures 346.5, the high, the low at 333. Settlement price 345.25. They were up 12. In July futures 352 on the high, the low at 339. settled 351.5. They were up 12.25. September futures 357.5. The high, the low at 345. Settled 356.75. Up 12.75 for the September wheat. December futures 365. The high, the low at 352. Settlement price 363.25. Up 12.25 for the day. March corn now 216.5. The high, the low at 211. Settled 214.5. They were up 3 cents. The May futures up a penny and a quarter at 222.75 with a high of 25 even and a low at 19.5. July corn futures 231. The high, the low at 226. Settled 229.75. Up 2.25. And the September futures in the corn pit 239. The high, the low at 232. Settled 235.25. They were up 3/4. December futures were up 3.5 cents today. 242.5. The high, the low at 39, and in settlement price at 42 even. March oats 161.5. The settlement price up 4. The May futures up 5.75 at 152.75. From the soy complex, March soybeans today 618.5. The high, low at 605. Settled 615.5. They were up 18 cents. May futures up 17.5, 6.24 the high, the low at $6.11 a bushel, and the May bean settled at $6.22, once again 17.5 higher. July futures 6.26.5 the high, the low at 6.14, settled 6.25, up 16.5 in the August soybeans. 6.26 the high, the low at 6.19, settled 6.24.75, up 17.75. September futures 6.20 the high, the low at 6.17, settled 6.18, they were up 14. And November beans for the day had a high of 6.20, a low at 6.11, settled $6.19, up 11 for the new crop November soybeans. March bean meal, a 184.50 high, low at 180, settled 183 even, up 480. The May contract up 450 at 184.10. And the March bean oil now, 23.30, the high, the low at 22.90, settled 23.22. They were up 68 at 22.90. And the May bean oil at 23.35 settlement price, up 58 for the day. And that's the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here are the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange with Celeste Quinn.
Mostly higher day today on the Merc. March feeders 99.47.5, the high 98.60, the low 99.15, the settlement at up 75. April 98.45, the high 97.60, the low 97.92.5, the settlement that up 30. May 97.50, the high, the low 96.80, finishing at 97.25, up 32.5. February live cattle 88.25, the high 86.80, the low 87.22.5, the settlement that down 60. March 88.90, the high 87.35, the low 87.35, the settlement that up 135. April 86.95, the high 85.95, the low 86.05, the settlement that down a nickel. April lean hog 74.65, the high 73.92.5, the low 74.22.5, the settlement that up 7.5. May 76.55, the high 75.85, the low 76.47.5, the settlement that up 37.5. June 79.37.5, the high 78.85, the low 79.30, the settlement that up 35. July 75.65.